Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
On this exclusive episode of Killer Jeans.
An inmate at Nevada Department of Corrections, Ely State Prison.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
A man convicted of double murder says he's innocent, but his past comes back to haunt him.
I didn't kill my wife in Utah, Becky, and I had nothing to do with killing my wife in Nevada.
The following episode of Killer Jeans contains graphic and sensitive information and material. Listener discretion is advised.
Emmy-nominated true crime journalists bring you cases like you've never heard them before. Hear firsthand accounts from the victims' families, private investigators, lawyers, law enforcement, and even the convicted. Giving you a complete 360 of the case like no one else can.
I'm Melissa McCarty.
I'm Kelly McClear.
And this is Killer Jeans.
Welcome to our debut case for Season 1 of Killer Jeans. This two-part story is a special early release.
Yes, welcome. And a little about us. Kelly and I met on a national show called Crime Watch Daily with Chris Hansen. We quickly became good friends, and we've been telling true crime stories in television for 30 years combined.
We've also told stories for Oxygen's Accident, Suicide, or Murder, HLN's Sex and Murder, Central Ave, and the CBS Network. Melissa and I wanted to move to podcast because we have more freedoms in telling a story. We can take warranted risks, diving much, much deeper. And we hope you'll learn more about us along the way, as well as the cases. The journey starts on death row.
That's what this is all about. Not whether I'm innocent or guilty, because I'm innocent. It's about not getting a fair trial and the corruption.
That's Thomas Randolph, speaking from death row in Nevada. He's been called many things, a serial killer, a socio and psychopath, and the Black Widower. Why? Because he's been married 6 times, and 4 of his wives are dead.
Randolph, now talking to me for the first time ever, takes us exclusively into his life. 2 murder trials 30 years apart, each marriage, and why he's fighting for a new evidentiary hearing and appealing his death penalty conviction.
Like many people, the allure of Las Vegas captivated Utah native Thomas Randolph, who worked in and out of law offices while gambling with his luck at life, with a past of teetering the legal lines, selling drugs on the side.
Well, I've always come to Vegas because I play 21. I'm actually really good at it. I make good money. I make more money than I make working for the state full-time and teaching school part-time, and you don't have to pay taxes on it. So I love to gamble. So I go to Vegas, and I go to Lake Powell.
He also took a shot at internet dating. That's where he met his soon-to-be 6th wife, Sharon.
Sharon had just lost her husband. He died of cancer. I'd lost Francis the year before, or earlier that year. And I'd get on it. I'd be off of it. I wouldn't respond to any of these. And Sharon keeps hitting on me. And finally, I got an email that says, hey, you know, if you don't think I'm attractive or you like boys or whatever, something that caught my attention. She was very rude about it, so it caught my attention. I actually knew Sharon better than I knew most women in my life because we talked for hours and hours. She'd be the last voice I heard at night, and then first thing in the morning she'd call me because she gets up earlier in the time difference. And when I met her in person, it just, everything clicked. She loved to dance.
Sharon has a daughter who also lives in Las Vegas, Colleen. What's your mom like?
My mom, she's really nice. she had a lot of friends, and she liked to go out and have a good time. She's very outgoing. She cut hair, and she liked to bake. She was good to him.
The pair were avid gamblers and nestled in fast. Randolph decided to leave his home in Utah, which was directly next door to his parents.
So just walked next door and you're at my mom and dad's. And I mean, we always used each other's house and were close, me and my family. So I hated moving away.
In 2008, nearing the Las Vegas blazing hot summer months, Randolph's luck would run out. A 911 call comes in. It's a home invasion robbery.
My wife's been shot, and there's a guy in my house, and I shot him. Heavy.
Is he hurt too? Is he hurt too?
I hope she's dead.
Where is your wife in the house?
She's in the hall in the bedroom. She's been shot bad.
Okay. Where is she shot at? Do you know?
Yeah, I think in the head.
Randolph and his wife Sharon were out to dinner and decided to head home early instead of catching a movie. As Randolph pulled the car in, Sharon got out and walked into the house. Did you hear the first gunshot?
No, I didn't. I can't hear. I wear hearing aids.
As he walked through the garage door into the house, he saw his wife Sharon, 47 years old, in a pool of blood, lying face down at the end of the hallway. He recounts what happened in a taped walkthrough video with police.
I get right here and Sharon's laying in the floor, face down, stopped right about here, had the door. I said, Sharon! Sharon! I thought I just seemed like a shadow or something.
Randolph, scared, says he reached for his 9mm gun in a nearby closet.
He's right up on me. Just right up on me. We actually touched right about here. He kind of rushed up on me a little bit, and that's when I just pushed him. Boom, boom! And I mean, I actually got close. Boom, boom! And I don't know if I shot him once. I shot him twice. He wasn't moving.
The man lying dead in the garage was Mike Miller, 38 years old, a skilled mason, a man Randolph referred to as his handyman and friend who did odd jobs for him now and then.
Is the guy still in the house, do you know?
No, he's in the garage. He pushed me by and ran on out. I know him. He stripped me off.
I shot Miller the first time, and I'm aiming for dead center mass, his heart.
Did you see it was Mike Miller, or did he have a mask on at that point?
He had a mask on, but he pulled it up because I think when we butted into each other.
Miller was shot in the torso and the head. The police walkthrough video conducted 1 week after the shootings would later become a major piece of evidence during the trial. As a disclaimer, Randolph says he was heavily medicated on opioids that day. He suffers from chronic pain and has always been on a high dose. He tried to cancel the interview, but investigators said it would only take him 10 minutes.
You look at me and see how red my eyes are, how glassy they are. I'm kind of wobbling, and I can't even make a sentence.
The video recording was an hour long.
I'm not sleeping. I'm stressed, you know, and everything. So, no, I take 340 milligram OxyContin every day. I take 330 milligrams oxycodone. And the difference is OxyContin is time release. You watch the walkthrough. I'm on Valium, two Valiums a day.
Even if Randolph was foggy-headed, he was a willing participant of it, and investigators questioned every word in the tape, comparing it to the forensics on scene.
The shootout in the hallway didn't happen because there's no evidence to suggest it. The first piece of ballistic evidence, that is, for firing a weapon, is one shell casing from Randolph's gun, so that's an expended fired round, just inside the door inside the home, which is exactly where it could end up as he's walking out and he fires the first round into the back of Mike Miller as the double cross began.
Las Vegas prosecutor David Stanton says there were no bullet holes in Miller's ski mask.
Claim by Randolph that, oops, another mistake. He's a masked gunman in his house when he starts unloading, but there's no holes in his ski mask. As I held the ski mask up in front of the jury when I argued this to him, other than the eye hole and the mouth holes, there's no other defects to that ski mask.
There were no bullet holes or casings or blood splatters in the hallway where Randolph says he first started shooting. He disputes police findings, saying speed played a role.
How fast can you run 6 feet if I'm shooting at you? Pretty damn fast. So Miller sees the gun. He's trying to get his gun. I've already got my gun out, and I'm shooting at him. Now, I'm aiming for his chest. I shot him, but in the meantime, he turned.
If they were friends, what's Miller's motive for the alleged break-in? Would Mike Miller turn on you after all the help you were giving him? You were paying him to do certain jobs. You talked a lot. You were buds. You went shooting together at one point, too, right? Why would he turn on you?
Well, we never actually shot. Sharon was with us. There was a bunch of people there, so we could shoot the guns. We went up there and just left. But he's desperate. He told me he had all this child support and warrants for him. I got all this money. I tell him I just cashed the annuity check for $22,600. I carry cash. Everybody will tell you this. There's $2,000 in my trunk, emergency money, and somebody's tried to get it. The cops said they didn't. Miller tried to get it out of my trunk because he knows it's there.
You think he sold you out in premeditated killing both of you for your money?
No. He knew I had the cash, and he knew we were going out that night to dinner, where we were going, because he was with me earlier that night.
Randolph says Miller's plan changed when they came home early. Prosecutor David Stanton says Randolph and Miller were never friends. Miller was his pawn.
Mike Miller is a black man. He's semi-homeless. He's got a family here. Mother and father, brother, that are close to him, concerned about him, and all of a sudden, has a very, very intense relationship with a guy that they've never seen before and is not the typical type of person that Mike Miller would associate with, and that's Thomas Randolph. Age-wise, interest-wise, hobbies-wise, Randolph's not working.
Stanton says Randolph was selling drugs, opioids, a lucrative business in Las Vegas, and he first lured Miller in for a drug operation.
So in a very short period of time, matter of months, Miller goes from no one's ever heard of Thomas Randolph to the point that they're inseparable. Their testimony from the Miller side of the family and in the investigation is, it was so awkward and so unusual that Randolph would call dozens of times a day wanting to know where Mike was, and that he wanted to go out, take Mike out to the desert and shoot guns. And Mike Miller had never done that before, had never expressed an interest in weapons, firing weapons. They actually thought Thomas Randolph was a homosexual, that he was gay, and that he was trying to come on really strong in this relationship for that reason.
Randolph says he was on opioids for his pain, but gave up dealing.
I haven't sold drugs or anything for, back in the 80s, the 90s at the latest, and this is, 2009. So we're talking 20 years. I've been...
You weren't selling opioids at that time in Las Vegas? Opioids?
That's what they say. That's what, and again, I'm not charged with selling opioids. I wasn't selling dope at all.
Sharon's daughter, Colleen, met Mike Miller a few times. Do you think Mike Miller was someone that got sucked in and manipulated and was a pawn? Do you ever remember Mike Miller? Any interactions with him?
Yeah. And definitely a pawn. He was not smart at all. And he seemed like a desperate kind of guy. No money, no job, no car, no place, you know. But yeah, because that's what Tommy does. He gets other people do his dirty work. His MO.
Records show the two men talked more than 300 times weeks prior to the shootings.
Nobody was conspiring to kill anybody. Bullshit. Total bullshit. And 300 phone calls, big deal. 200 of them was answering machines. And she said, they're just short messages. We're going to pizza. You want to go with us? Me and Sharon, we're going to pizza. You want to go with us? We're going to the bar. You want to go with us? He's got nothing. He didn't plan on killing us. He came home. He planned on robbing us because the next day we were leaving. And all that money's going with me. And I'm buying 5 acres in somewhere in Beaver around the middle of Utah.
The prosecutor says Randolph also delayed in calling for help because they have the incident clocked down to the minute from the time Randolph pulled into the garage to the 911 call.
A neighbor across the street who's not close with the Randolphs, but he's outside working on his car, and he's on his cell phone talking to his friend. That is an important thing because the homicide detectives and Dean O'Kelly in particular get those records, and we now have a clock.
Just listen to the 911 call as the operator is trying to get Randolph to focus on his wife, Sharon, who's bleeding on the floor.
Put her flat on her back.
Put her flat on her back. I hope this is dead. Should I try to find this gun or something so he don't shoot me if he's not dead?
Is he moving?
No.
Go get his gun. Go get his gun quickly. Let's focus on your wife. Put her flat on her back.
I'm going to lock the garage so he can't get in.
Okay. Sir, you've got to do this quickly.
Okay.
Put her flat on her back.
Oh, fuck. There's blood everywhere.
All right. I'm going to help you, but I need you to listen to me so we can try to help her. You got to listen to me so we can try to help her. Okay, put her flat on her back.
Okay, hang on just a minute.
Sir?
Oh, God. Sharon. Oh, fuck.
What's your status, Metro?
We're at the number for several minutes. We're for event number 3131.
Oh, fuck, Sharon.
Sir, can you hear me?
Sharon, no.
Sir.
Oh, God.
Sir, come back to the phone.
Oh, fuck. I can't roll it, but I had a bad back. It's just got guns everywhere.
She's got what everywhere?
Blood and stringy stuff everywhere.
You can't move her?
I can't get her to roll. Okay, I'm going to try again.
We got to try to do CPR. I need you to try.
Detectives argued the delay was Randolph buying time to make sure both his wife Sharon and the alleged trigger man Mike Miller were dead, and to plant evidence that the deaths were the result of a burglary gone wrong.
The first time Mike Miller realized that he had been double-crossed was when the first bullet ripped through his body, which would have been right as he stepped outside into the garage. That matches the ballistics as far as the shell casings, where the bullets end up, because most of the bullets in his body are through and through. They're perforating. The ones in the head are found right under the body because it's concrete underneath of his head. That's why they are classic execution head wounds.
As investigators dig deeper into Randolph's life and his self-defense heroics, they discover he had 4 life insurance policies out on Sharon, totaling $360,000. Randolph says all policies Sharon signed up for on her own, doing full medical exams.
They bring a nurse out to our house. We're in Utah at my house that I have there. And they bring her, the nurse out, and she asks more questions. She gives Sharon a physical. I can't insure Sharon. It's her application, her insurance, and I'm just the beneficiary. It's a murder because I secretly took insurance out on her. That's impossible. You can't do that.
As investigators take an even closer look, they are stunned to learn Randolph faced a murder trial for another wife more than 30 years ago in Utah. In 1989, Randolph was on trial, charged with murdering his then-second wife, Becky Galt, who he says committed suicide.
Randolph has never talked about his first murder trial in Utah or the death of his second wife, Becky Galt. What you are about to hear is his version of events, because most of those involved decades ago are dead or untraceable, and the police records no longer exist. Now, because of all of this, Becky's death ends up determining Randolph's fate 30 years later in Las Vegas with the murder of his sixth wife, Sharon. We start with who Randolph was in 1989. This was during a time he was in his 20s, working at a law firm in the hopes of becoming a lawyer.
I was just, I was still wanting to be a lawyer until I, you know, got carried away with the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, fast cars, fast women, fast boats, fast planes, you know, and then it, all of the Pink Floyd song about the clock's ticking, and all of a sudden 20 years has passed, and you say to yourself, wow, I blew it.
Days before he married Becky, he was finalizing a divorce from first wife Kathy Thomas, the mother to his daughter Krista and son, ironically named Justice.
Justice is my gift to the world. I want to clarify that. So is my daughter Krista. She's very smart. I didn't plan her. I planned Justice, like I told you. I knew I was going to get Kathy pregnant, and whether I married her or not, I picked her because she looked like Farrah Fawcett Majors, just no boobs. So I knew she'd make beautiful babies. So, Kathy, okay, I'm an asshole. I cheated on her. But there's a lot of reasons I cheated on her. She didn't satisfy me, okay? Shouldn't have cheated on her. Should have divorced her. She knew about Becky.
With candor, Randolph says his first marriage to Kathy ended because of his affair with Becky, who he married soon after. He says the weeks leading up to Becky's death were contentious.
The cocaine got her, just like it does a lot of people. So, just shortly before her death, she had had the same job for like 10 years, one of the best paying jobs in the state at the warehouse. And I was having an affair, and the drugs was getting the best of both of us.
Randolph says Becky had made prior attempts to take her life during their marriage.
She overdosed. Then they made her go to a shrink, and she said, yeah, she's suicidal. She probably won't take pills now because she won't be able to get them. And that led up to all this. So she loses her job.
Randolph tells me at the time he was dealing drugs and Becky was seeking some the day she died, but he refused to supply her. Instead, he says he gave her an ultimatum.
One way or the other. In the morning, you're either going to the doctor or I'm going to the lawyer and I'm filing for divorce. And I'll take you off the list to pick up the kids. I'll change the phone number, the pager number. You know, you'll be dead to me. It's got to stop.
Speaking for the first time ever publicly, Randolph's mom, Dorothy, describes a visit Becky made to her home the day she died.
When she left, she didn't say a word to me or nothing. And we met on the stairs. And she had something shoved up of this little white coat she wore. She was real tiny. She wasn't short, but tiny. And she had something shoved up. And it looked just exactly like my carton of Benson Hedges cigarettes. And I thought, well, to me, I thought, how sad. All she had to do was ask for them, and I would have gave them to her. And then she went outside, and I went back to the slats. And she was down on her hands and knees, putting something, or that's what I thought she was doing, under the seat.
So you believe that this thing that Becky was hiding was, in fact, a gun that belonged to you?
It was a gun, honey. I didn't know it was a gun until the lawyers told me. And then when I was on the stand and everything, the other side, they brought the gun out in the holster. And he said, this looks like a carton of cigarettes to you. I said it did when I seen it.
My mom is an angel, but it's tough love. And that's why I moved in. She just finally told me, it's simple. You can party. You're not going to stop till you want to stop, but I'm not going to put your son through it. I will get a lawyer and take your boy away from you. Well, that's enough to clean me up.
Randolph says hours before Becky died, he threw one last verbal dagger.
And this is the guilt in it. I just lost it. And I said, I am so fucking sick and tired of you saying you're going to kill yourself. If you're going to kill yourself, just do it and put everybody out of your fucking misery, Becky. I've had it. And I, you know, up to here, and I'm chilling her up to my throat. I've had it. I can't deal with this shit no more. If you're going to do it, fucking do it and get it over with. I never really thought that she was going to do anything like that. And I don't know why I was being such an asshole. And I left. I went outside. I started to get in the car. And I got maybe 20 foot down the driveway to the car. And I don't know why I did this. I came back in the house. And I mean, she's just hysterical crying. And when I come in, she sees me. And I can see the life come back in her eyes. And all I had to, she reached out for me. And all I had to do was just take her hand, tell her I love her, tell her we're going to get through this. And I don't know why in the world I did it. And I said, you know, I think my climbing ropes is downstairs. Maybe you can hang yourself. And I walked out. It's at 11 o'clock. And I walked out. And that was the last time I seen her alive.
Now, Becky Galt's death was 30 plus years ago. Many around during that time have passed away, so this is Randolph's account, saying that he stormed out, made a pit stop at a bar. When he later drives to the store, he's tailed by police. He pulls over, his plates are run, and he's arrested for a DUI. Now, the next day he's released, his dad picks him up from jail, takes him to get his car from the impound. At this point, Randolph moved back home with his parents. Becky was supposed to be staying there with him, but says she didn't like it. She felt smothered by Randolph's mom. So for some reason, she goes back to the now abandoned home that she used to share with Randolph.
Right, a home he stopped paying the bills on, so it was vacant. Now, this is his account because there are no police reports on this. Randolph tells me on the day he was released from jail, he drove to the home looking for a car tool in the garage from an issue caused by the tow truck taking his car to the impound when he was arrested.
So I opened the garage, and there's Becky's car. And I thought, well, that's not right. So I go upstairs, and there's Becky lying in bed. She's still got the gun in her hand. The gun is jammed open. And that's an important thing because they screwed up when they did this investigation. She's on a waterbed, but it's not a typical waterbed. So she's laying there, and I put my hand on her hand to make sure she, you know, I didn't know if she just shot herself or what, because I just got home, and she's dead. And I immediately come out, get back in the truck. Now, see, they said, oh, that's nonsense, but our phone's off. The power's off. The gas is off. The lights is off. I'm not living there. Becky can't afford it, so there's no sense paying for it. And they said the house was in foreclosure. I think we was a month behind.
He runs outside to tell his dad Becky is dead.
So we went to my dad's house, which is just 10 minutes away, and called 911. They come, and because of I'm, you know, the reputed drug dealer, when they come to my parents' house, not the house where Becky's at, my house, but my parents' house, they haven't even seen a body yet. and they arrest me for suspicion of murder and take me to the police
station. You have 1 minute left.
So that's the day she killed herself.
But in 1989, Randolph was charged with the murder of Becky Galt, his second wife. During the Utah trial of Becky's death, prosecutors focused on Randolph's lifestyle and his drug dealing.
It seems like everybody and their brother wanted to bust me for drugs. That's what the Utah case is about, the drugs and all the women I had sex with. And it's not criminal. It may be not good if you're married, but or they're married, but it's not criminal. The times were different back in the 80s than they are today.
Police questioned the way Becky was found lying on the waterbed, the position of the gun, her head wound, with experts even weighing in, saying perhaps someone moved her. Randolph often speaking to me as if he were a lawyer, an occupation he was studying to become at the time, compiled every document he could in his Utah case. He reads the coroner's report for Becky.
Dr. Edward Swinney, the pathologist who performed the autopsy, it was his opinion that Becky's body was moved after she was shot. And again, he's our best witness, and we include his transcripts from a preliminary hearing. And he says the body wasn't moved. She was shot where she was at. She died from a numerous things. My poor Becky lived for a half an hour. And he says definitely her arm could have moved. Her legs could have moved, probably would have moved, because she would have been in terrible pain.
There wasn't enough evidence surrounding the actual shooting scene where Becky died. Utah detectives charged him with murder in part because of a star witness in Becky's case, a guy named Eric Tarantino, Randolph's associate he met at work.
Eric Tarantino, every word out of his mouth, you just shove a foot down his throat because he's lying. He's crazy as hell.
When the two men met, they were early 20s. Randolph was running a cabinet shop and needed hired help.
So I hired him as a favor to this guy, and then I had to keep him for 6 months, and he was a total screw-up. He cost me money. I couldn't wait till the 6 months was up. When the 6 months was up, I let him go.
Las Vegas prosecutor David Stanton says he was more than that. Randolph was grooming Tarantino, and Tarantino feared Randolph.
Was a man to be feared with in this area of Utah during this time period. He was fascinated and loved the movie Scarface. He had a crew of people that worked for him doing criminal acts, smuggling narcotics through the airport, transporting and selling it, doing a number of criminal enterprises there in the Utah area. And he demanded that a lot of his crew, his friends, call him Tony, referencing to Tony Montana, the principal figure in the Scarface movie. And that's the persona. And if you look at, you know, Randolph, especially even back then, he's a young man, but, you know, Tony Montana, he's not. But he, and the detectives confirmed this, was a person that was greatly feared within a certain community within Utah.
Stanton says Randolph tried to hire Tarantino to kill his second wife, Becky. Tarantino testified on all the ways he and Randolph discussed killing her, the slow grooming phase.
And we're talking months. This is not just, and it's at work, it's after work, at the bars, it's at social events. And so then it morphs from, have you ever been mad enough to kill somebody? If you caught your wife cheating, do you think you could kill that person? And so then it's permutations on a theme. And then what happens if I ask you to? And then ultimately it leads to Randolph asking Tarantino, would you kill my wife? For how much? What circumstances?
With this damaging evidence, Randolph was booked into police custody pending the trial for Becky. During his stay, an incident takes place in a housing cell. Utah prosecutors claim it was a jailhouse attempt to kill their star witness, Eric Tarantino, using an undercover cop. So what went down when you had to plead guilty to tampering with a witness regarding Tarantino?
So I knew he was doing drugs besides just smoking pot. And he still owed me $600-700 that I loaned him for a car. And then, you know, I told him don't buy it. But anyway, so all I was going to do was get somebody to plant drugs in his car. So you don't want him dead. Besides that, it looked bad. But I just wanted the guy to plant dope in his car and a gun.
The person that that Thomas Randolph ultimately hired to do, let's for purposes of Randolph's version, do some criminal act against Eric Tarantino, was an undercover police officer that was brought in specifically from an outside jurisdiction so that no one locally within this area would have ever seen this guy before. Those conversations were recorded. His girlfriend testified and was interviewed by police that Thomas Randolph offered money and a title to their car, and she was the person delivered it to physically deliver those items to the undercover officer for the express purpose of killing Eric Tarantino.
Ultimately, Randolph pled guilty to witness tampering over the Tarantino incident. As for the murder charge of Becky Galt, he was acquitted, and her death was ruled a suicide. What was going through your mind?
I wasn't worried. I wasn't worried because I knew I didn't do anything.
After the Utah verdict in 1989, Becky Galt's mom spoke to a local news station, absolutely stunned by the ruling. She delivered a haunting warning.
I think it's very unfair and unjust. He's guilty. And he's just going to kill somebody else's daughter, so beware.
At this point, Randolph has been cleared, free. His records in Utah now expunged, files are sealed. And Randolph went on with his life and married 4 more times. Now, fast forward to the deaths of Sharon Randolph and Mike Miller. As Las Vegas detectives are investigating, they uncover the Utah murder acquittal case and all of Randolph's past wives when looking for a motive. And it would turn out all of his marriages would come back to haunt him. Every word, every action with these women. Randolph's defense team tries to prevent the resurfacing of his past, and in doing so, it ignited a legal battle. A battle that would take so long, it made Randolph the longest-serving inmate in Nevada, awaiting to go before a jury. For the double murder trial of wife Sharon and Mike Miller, Randolph would wait almost 10 years.
Well, Kelly, 2 big legal issues at hand. Allowing in prior bad acts, that's what was used to convict Bill Cosby. Allowing in past women with a similar story to show a pattern of behavior. Now, this argument for Randolph would allow his past wives, or if they are dead, their loved ones to testify. And another issue was allowing in details from his Utah murder case he was acquitted of. What followed is what Randolph calls unjust.
These people in Utah lied, cheated, and stole. And then the Nevada people, since they're using the same exact witnesses from 35 years ago.
Las Vegas prosecutor David Stanton says there was an evidentiary hearing where the judge approved the witness list and the use of prior bad acts because it met the standards for both.
We filed the motion, detailed, lengthy motion, outlining a bunch of different things and a bunch of different witnesses that we were going to call that basically gave the description of the surrounding events and people involved with Thomas and Becky Randolph, both prior to and after her death, and in my opinion, her murder. And that involved a number of different people, obviously the prosecutor, one of the detectives, Scott Conley from Utah, and then, of course, Eric Tarantino.
During the trial in Las Vegas, Randolph's defense attorney, Randall Pike, says the prosecutors skewed the lines in their verbal delivery to jurors.
The state would keep the state in the prosecution of this case would make references to the Tarantino incident as a murder for hire case. And not witness tampering as the court had ordered them to refer to it. And they went through and in this case in Nevada, we had to deal with the fact that the state was trying to portray Mr. Randolph as a serial killer.
What's not allowed in are the trial transcripts, the police reports, and all evidence presented there. However, there are exemptions to a sealed case, as Las Vegas prosecutor David Stanton explains.
The coroner's office in Davis County, Utah, is not a party to the sealing order. And so what a sealing order doesn't do, much to Mr. Randolph's chagrin, is that the findings, the photographs, the doctor's assessment at autopsy of Becky Randolph, they're not sealed. They're not a party to that order. And, you know, for good reason. And in no jurisdiction at any time, at any point in our history, has that law ever been interpreted anything else besides that. So, I'm sure Randolph would hope that that means everybody's lips are sealed and no one can speak about it again in any circumstances and any proceeding. That's A, simply not true, and B, it's laughable.
Pike, on the defense, questions the motives of the Utah prosecutor who lost his case to Randolph and the Utah detective who delivered a flawed investigation, now coming to testify in his Las Vegas trial, even though the judge allowed it.
The fact that they subsequently were sued by Mr. Randolph and he obtained a judgment against them is impeachment material. It doesn't stop them from getting on the stand.
Randolph sued the Utah Players for a malicious prosecution after he was acquitted in 1989 and settled for an undisclosed amount.
It was an abuse of discretion by the court, and that's still pending in front of the Nevada Supreme Court.
The defense feels there are Brady violations, meaning it was an obligation of the state to produce any exculpatory evidence, which is evidence that could favor a defendant or show innocence to the defense. Defense attorney Randall Pike says none of that was offered up when the Utah case was brought into the Las Vegas case, a case Randolph was acquitted of.
It was a sealed order. The court in Utah expunged the records, ordered them sealed, and that material, as far as that order, should never have been in the possession of the prosecutors, and arguably, in which we argued that it should not have, any of that should not have been in the possession of the detective. We know that there was exculpatory evidence that was sufficient to have the jury acquit Mr. Randolph.
The Utah detective was allowed to testify using his personal memory from the 30-year-old case instead of referring to sealed police reports.
He says, these aren't the state's files. These aren't the Ogden City Police files. These aren't city records. These are his personal records. Cops don't have personal files. I sued him. I'm going to be convicted and given the death penalty in Nevada for something I didn't do, based on something I didn't do 35 years ago in Utah. It's just crazy. The statewide, they had my expunged files. They knew they were illegal. They conspired to circumvent the law.
Las Vegas prosecutor David Stanton responds to Randolph's allegations.
That reading of a sealing order is patently absurd. It doesn't apply in the fashion that he would hope it to be, number one. Number two, I've never reviewed any documents from either Becky Randolph's murder or Eric Tarantino's solicitation to whack Becky. Never reviewed anything. We did what I think any reasonable prosecutor would do, is you hear about these things and you find out, hey, is that person alive? And can I talk to him? Thomas Randolph has always believed that we possess some police file that's in violation of the previous sealing order. And that's what he would like to hang his hat on, I would imagine, among other things, to reverse his conviction.
Las Vegas prosecutors painted a pattern of behavior for jurors. Two murder trials 30 years apart, two wives who died from gunshot wounds, two alleged hitmen for hire, and life insurance policies as the motive. In 2017, after a long, drawn-out legal battle of old and new laws surrounding this unique case, Thomas Randolph hears his fate for the murder of his sixth wife, Sharon, and her killer, Mike Miller.
We, the jury in the above-entitled case, find the defendant, Thomas William Randolph, as follows. Count 1, conspiracy to commit murder. Guilty of conspiracy to commit murder. Count 2, murder with the use of a deadly weapon. Sharon caused Randolph, guilty of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon. Count 3, murder with the use of a deadly weapon, Michael James Miller, guilty of first-degree murder with the use of a deadly weapon. Dated this 28th day of June, 2017.
In part 2 of our exclusive with the alleged Black Widower, Randolph fights for his life during the penalty phase of his double murder conviction, and we hear from two of his past wives. And Randolph shares some revealing details about each marriage.
And looking ahead on our season debut of Killer Jeans, a teacher is found dead in a Delaware River, not far from her home. But who was driving her car? And a father serving a life sentence for the murder of his daughter says he's innocent, and we'll bring you the evidence that points to her being alive. This has been Killer Jeans.
And we always want to hear from you. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Killer Jeans, the podcast.